too low for me because neither of us have glasses, which allows us to look at the proper height for the other person. So we'll have to adjust it after I introduce the speaker. So welcome to another session of the Vancouver Institute. After tonight's lecture, we will have three more Saturday night lectures. And the speakers and subjects of those lectures are as follows. Next week, on March the 20th, President David Williams, the president of Wolfson College and the chairman of the law faculty at Cambridge University, will speak on the subject, Environment and the Law. On March 27th, Professor Gordon Skilling, one of Canada's leading political scientists, will speak on the subject of great topical importance, Poland and the future of Eastern Europe. And then our final lecture for this Vancouver Institute season will be given on April the 3rd by Professor G.J. Wasserberg of the Department of Geological and Planetary Sciences of the California Institute of Technology on the subject Stars, Gas, Dust, and Planets. We warmly invite you to attend all of these lectures and to bring your friends. Now, I think it's correct to state that the nature of the Vancouver Institute as a volunteer organization is well indicated by our speaker this evening. You all know of those amateur theatrical companies which put on brilliant performances in which you buy your ticket from one person at the entrance, are ushered to your seat by another, and when the play begins, both of them are on the stage, performing respectively as Romeo and Juliet or Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. At the intermission, they sell you sandwiches and gin in the lobby while still wearing their theatrical attire. Well, the Vancouver Institute is a bit like this. Tonight's speaker, Dennis Chitty, is a member of the executive of the Institute. Further, every Saturday night, he looks after the seating arrangements in this hall. And tonight, after he has handled the seating arrangements, he has come down to the front to give this evening's lecture. Surely this is the kind of organization that merits your financial support. We make your money go a very long way with volunteers like Professor Chitty, which is why our members' fees are so low. As I have said, $2 student, $10 single, $15 for a family. With inflation, these fees, in fact, get progressively lower every week. Our membership's rates are so low that I feel no embarrassment in asking you to join, even although our winter season is slowly drawing to a close. Memberships will continue to be available in the hall after this lecture and after the three succeeding lectures right up to April the 3rd. Well, let me briefly give you some biographical information on tonight's speaker. Professor Dennis Chitty received his honors biology degree from the University of Toronto in 1935. He received his DPhil from Oxford University in 1949. From 1935 to 1961, he was a senior research officer in the Bureau of Animal Population at the University of Oxford. From 1961 to 1978, he was a professor in the Department of Zoology at this university. Dr. Chitty has extensive publications to his credit dealing with a broad range of zoological subjects. In 1968, recognition of his contribution to the field of zoology, he was made a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. This university, to recognize his teaching skills and teaching contributions, awarded him the Master Teaching Award for his outstanding lecturing ability. With this background, we are all very much looking forward to his lecture this evening on Do Lemmings Commit Suicide? Professor Dennis Chitty.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, or at least those of you whom I have not already greeted in my capacity as bouncer. I'm now going to fulfill my other function of spare wheel, because as you know, we've had a blowout, and I am filling in for somebody who is going to talk on a musical topic. Now, if there are any musicians in this audience who've accidentally strayed in and find it difficult to get out, please let them not be embarrassed. They may certainly leave, because if they are anxious to know the answer to the question tonight, do lemmings commit suicide, I can give it to them now and they can leave. But the rest of our members, of course, expect to, for their fees, to be instructed for at least an hour, which I propose to do. So if, in order to turn this into something of a cliffhanger, if everybody would shut their eyes except those who wish to leave, I will now give the answer to the question. Now, lemmings are small rodents, and they live on the tops of mountains in Scandinavia and on the tundra in the Arctic and subarctic regions throughout the Northern Hemisphere. And in order that you may get some idea of their size, I'm asking my colleague, Miss Sharon Barton, down here to show you one or two stuffed specimens. So Sharon, could you come up here and just tell us what you have?
What I have here, right here, if you can see, is a brown lemming. It's not alive, it's stuffed. And this brown lemming lives in wet climates, and it does not change its skin color, okay, fur color. Whereas in the dry climates, we have gray lemmings in the spring, and wintertime they change to white. Okay, and these are the variable lemmings. And their litter size ranges from 3 to 9.
Thank you, Sharon. Well, Sharon will be coming on later on in the program to help me with what is behind the screen there. So I thought this would be a convenient opportunity to introduce her. Thank you, Sharon. Now, all of us, I expect, have heard of lemmings one way or another, and most of us, through the jokes about them, the sort of thing where you see a cartoon with a lot of lemmings falling over the side of a cliff, and one lemming says to the other, "This is the last time I take a booking on one of these mass excursions." Yeah. Or you can have, further back in the crowd of lemmings as they approach the cliff, one lemming wearing a life preserver, and the lemming on his left says, "You're a disgrace to all lemmings." They've also entered the sociological literature, and here is an Italian sociologist comparing the behavior of his fellow countrymen to that of the lemmings. He writes, "From time to time, lemmings form enormous gatherings, millions of them, stretching from horizon to horizon. And then at a certain point, they start racing as hard as they can go towards the sea, where they dive in and drown. Scientists have never managed to discover why." Just as sociologists don't really know why many Italians are so tenaciously pursuing national suicide. They have also entered into religion, and here is a form of exorcism which used to be read in the churches of Norway. "I exorcise you, destructive mice, by God the Father Almighty and Jesus Christ his Son and the Holy Ghost, proceeding from both, to depart forthwith from these lands and to cross over to those places where you can harm no one. And wheresoever you go, may you be accursed, disappearing from day to day and diminishing. Let him who will come to judge the living and the dead in this age by fire deem it worthy to perform this." Now, for those who doubt the efficacy of prayer, I may tell you that this prayer always works. The only trouble is it's only good for 4 years, and 4 years later, it's likely that another swarm of lemmings will be back again. Now, turning to a higher scientific level, here is an account which appeared in a respectable scientific journal by somebody who claimed to have witnessed one of these lemmings in the Northwest Territories, lemming migrations in the Northwest Territories. "For 4 days, I loaded my sled. And I soon realized, after I'd started, that I was cutting through a mass migration of lemmings. The lemmings were everywhere on the sea ice, all traveling due east. As far as the eye could see in any direction, the lemmings were on the march. They stopped for nothing. They never hesitated, but plunged from the edge of the ice to the water a foot below and swam across. On the other side, they tried vainly to climb the sheer wall of ice. Thousands drowned, but they came on in never-ending numbers. I estimated the average density was one lemming to every square yard. From start to finish, the movement lasted for 10 days, a very dramatic account. Now, going still higher in the evidence for these migrations, I want to quote you from a book which was written by Mr. Charles Elton, who is the father of animal ecology. And he wrote this in 1927 and repeated a lot of this information in another book in 1942. And he wrote as follows: every few years, lemmings migrate down into the lowland in immense numbers. They march chiefly at night and may traverse more than 100 miles of country before reaching the sea, into which they plunge unhesitatingly and continue to swim until they die. This migration is caused primarily by overpopulation in their mountain home, and the migrations are a symptom of the maximum in numbers, which is always terminated by a severe epidemic. And this reduces the population to a very few individuals. After such a lemming year, the mountains are almost empty of lemmings, a very convincing account. Now, the only problem about this is that if Darwin is right, how is this migratory impulse transmitted from generation to generation? Because, as has been said, the only ones that stay behind are the ones which do not migrate. So here we obviously have a conflict between observation, or at least interpretation, and theory. Now, this problem of do lemmings commit suicide is quite obviously a very trivial one. And apart from giving you an incomplete detective story this evening, I want to deal with one other issue which is far more important, namely the place of fundamental research, or pure research, or curiosity research in the university system. And in particular, I wish to back up an article by a colleague of mine in religious studies, Dr. William Nichols, who protested against the increasing tendency for the university to be forced to deal with purely practical subjects. And particularly with the intellectual Philistines we have over in Victoria, that danger is very acute. It is, of course, politically popular to make fun of the sorts of things that scientists do in universities. And one infuriated taxpayer, after reading the grants handed out some years ago by the National Research Council, wrote as follows to The Sun: how could anybody be so irresponsible and totally oblivious to the wishes of the Canadian public as to squander money on meaningless nonsense? I strongly object to my hard-earned money being thrown away on useless and, in some cases, degrading projects. And he then listed four of them. Number one, to continue study of religious crosses erected along the roads in French Canada, $13,000. For reassembly and study of the inscribed and decorated blocks of the temples of Akhenaten of Luxor, $55,000. To study prehistoric culture in North Africa, $33,000. And finally, to study air-breathing fish of the Amazon River, $170,000. Now, this hit list includes, for its last item, some colleagues of mine who had the quaint idea that in order to understand problems of circulation and respiration, it would be a very good idea to go to the Amazon and study the animals in which these processes first started several million years ago. On the other hand, the correspondence, to some extent, showed good judgment, because instead of sending a bunch of physiologists to the tropics He might better have sent a bunch of ecologists up to the Arctic to study this problem we're going to discuss tonight. Now, had our correspondent been writing at the turn of the century, he would almost certainly have seen an item such as this: money to study salivation in dogs. And if he had objected to this, he would have stopped and been successful. He would have stopped the work of Pavlov and would have delayed for several decades our understanding about digestion and conditioned reflexes. Now, Bertrand Russell writes this way: "The first impression of any non-scientific person when he learns what is going on in some famous laboratory is that all the investigators are wasting their time on trivialities. But the facts are that intellectually illuminating subjects are often such as are in themselves trivial and uninteresting." So, let us now, after this short digression, return to tonight's study of a trivial and uninteresting topic. My first slide is of the Norwegian lemming, which is the one which attracted the attention of the zoologist I've already mentioned, Mr. Charles Elton. In the Canadian Arctic, we have the two kinds that you've already seen from a distance, the brown lemming and the varying lemming. And in this slide, we see Mr. Charles Elton as he was at the age of about 27 when he wrote that most influential of all books in animal ecology. What he did was to reverse the trend which had started with Darwin for people to go into the lab and study problems there and to get back out into the field again. And nearly all the work which has gone on in the half century since that time stems from his inspiration. Now, I was very lucky to be associated with him just a few years before he wrote this second of his classical books on the lemming cycle. And one of the jobs I had to do was to pay a visit to the Eastern Arctic. And so after 4 years at Oxford, I came back to Canada and took the train up to Churchill and then took the supply vessel, the Naskapi, of the Hudson's Bay Company and made a trip out here all the way up Baffin Island to Ellesmere Island, across the Northwest Passage and back down the coast of Labrador to Halifax. Now, the choice of 1939 as the year for me to visit the Arctic was based on the assumption that there was a four-year cycle going on in the Arctic, and 1939 was supposed to be a peak year. Now, unfortunately, in this game, we're always being tripped up by what nature does to us. And on this occasion, it turned out that there had been a three-year cycle. So I went all those thousands of miles and only saw four lemmings. Three of these lemmings were at Baker Lake, which will enter our story later on. Now, this is the settlement at Baker Lake. And this is not a photograph that I took myself. This was taken some 20 years later, because unfortunately, on the way up to Churchill, I stopped off for breakfast in the station at the Pas. And while I was at breakfast, the front half of the train went on to Flin Flon and left me without a camera and without any warm clothes, which was not a very profitable start to this expedition. However, I was able to borrow some clothes, but not a camera. Another slide of Baker Lake, taken by somebody who will be introduced to you later on. Now, I don't need to remind you that 1939, when I went up there, was the year of the outbreak of the war, And this, of course, put paid to pure research at Oxford for the next 7 years. And you might like to see where I spent most of the war, which was in this on this little pig farm in the slums of Oxford. And I spent many an evening there while the bombers were roaring overhead on the way to Birmingham and Coventry, watching rats and seeing how I could induce them to take poison, because we were put on to applied zoology and were doing our best to save the limited food supplies in Great Britain. I don't have a record of my scientific record of my war work, but I had an artist friend who gave a little sketch of me going down to watch my rats and also the other activities, which were visiting farmers and trying to persuade them to let us do some experiments there. Now, my wife's job also came to an end with the outbreak of war. But fortunately, she only had a small family to raise and do a little wartime shopping. And as there wasn't much to buy, she didn't really have much to do. So she very kindly took over the running of the inquiry. And I want to show you the sorts of results that she plotted. Here we have a map of the Eastern Arctic. And each one of those little disks represents the reply given by people who were canvassed by questionnaires as to whether or not lemmings, snowy owls, and Arctic foxes were more abundant or less abundant in that year than in the preceding year. Now here you see 2 years after that year of great scarcity when I made my famous visit to Baker Lake, the yellow indicates that all those people thought that lemmings were much more abundant that year than the previous year. This was in 1940 to 41. The next year, as you will see, there are some red disks, which means that those people thought that the population peak was passed. And the next year, almost everybody agreed that the lemmings were much scarcer than they had been before. The two black disks indicate people said there was no change scarcity. The next year, you will see that once again, the cycle has turned. And the majority of the replies are for increase, the yellow. Now, there's one very fascinating thing about these replies, and that is these replies from way south of the range of the lemmings down in the forested region. And this obviously is good evidence for there being a mass migration of lemmings. Unfortunately, however, there is an alternative hypothesis, which is that I forgot to sweep the spare disks off the map when I was taking this photograph. And of the two, I prefer the latter explanation. The final slide in this series shows you that we are back at square one, and almost all the observers are reporting increase. Now, from this map, you will gather that not only is this cycle in numbers very pronounced, so that untrained observers can get a very good idea of what is going on, but also enormous areas of the Eastern Arctic, many of them completely unconnected with one another, are showing the same trends in population. And if you trace this record back, you can find out from the fluctuations in the fur returns of the foxes that this cycle in numbers has been going on for a long time. Here we see the number of fox pelts turned in each year at the Hudson Bay Company stores in exchange for supplies. So this is a remarkable phenomenon which obviously needs explaining. Now, as you all know, the explanation for the ending of the cycle in the lemming, which is the food for the fox and which explains why they fluctuate in abundance, is that after they have become too abundant, the lemmings very prudently commit suicide in order to regulate their numbers. And fortunately, we have a photographic record of this remarkable behavior. Here we have some lemmings rushing down to the sea in large numbers, very spectacular. And another intrepid photographer happened to be present at the time when one of the lemmings was throwing himself off a cliff into the sea. Now, as you know, the camera cannot lie, and therefore who am I to doubt that this suicide march is in fact a real phenomenon. Now, if we're going to study this, obviously we ought to see the animals in their proper context. And I have a film to show you, which will last about 11 minutes, which will show you the other actors in this northern drama.
Tip of Canada lie the Queen Elizabeth Islands. Well within the Arctic Circle, this archipelago is one of the few remaining places on the face of the earth where glaciers are still forming. In the higher altitudes, unmelted snow accumulates, pressing down layer upon layer, forcing the growing masses of ice to move. In times past, the icy fingers of glacial masses reached down over most of the North American continent, holding the land in a crushing grip. This was the Ice Age. Today, the earth is warmer, and the glaciers have retreated, melting away summer after summer. The slow catastrophe they brought to the land can now be seen. Veins of coal are evidence of the lush vegetation that formerly covered this frigid desert. Fossils of shellfish tell of a once almost tropical climate. These remains reveal the struggle that once took place between the forces of life and the onslaught of cold and ice. Today there is little moisture here and little life. The same glaciers which once brought death to the land now provide the summer's only steady supply of water. But sometimes this glacial runoff rushes across barren, half-frozen land and out into the sea, leaving behind a badly scarred desert. Just 1 foot above the ground, the Arctic air is often far too cold for plant life. And yet, plants do grow. Branches of the Arctic willow spread and hug the earth for warmth and moisture. For nearer the ground, the temperature may be up to 40 degrees warmer. The short summer season often prevents reproduction by seed. To overcome this, some species reproduce by depositing their buds on the ground where they take root. There are no bees here, and many Arctic plants rely upon the wind for pollen. Seeds, too, are often scattered by the wind, taking root by sheer chance. In the more unfriendly regions, only the most adaptable survive. The Arctic Earth is perpetually frozen beneath the surface soil. Water from melted winter snow is sometimes caught and held in pockets on the ground. Then, with the help of sun and warmer temperatures, colonies of vegetation move in. First, take root. Then later, grass. When they die, they nourish and enrich the soil, enabling other plants to follow. Soon a lush coat of vegetation covers the surrounding land. Where there is plant life in the Arctic, there are almost certain to be higher forms of life. Some Arctic animals depend directly upon the presence of vegetation for food. But in surviving, animals like the muskox, and especially the lemming, become themselves the chief sources of food for other Arctic animals. To escape the dangers of predators, the lemming rear their young beneath the ground. Only through the force of sheer numbers can defenseless animals like the lemming and the Arctic hare maintain their kind. Lacking the natural protection of bushes and trees, the plumage and eggs of many Arctic birds blend with the surrounding country. Almost all the birds here are summer visitors only. Red-throated loons sometimes come from as far south as Mexico. Many birds come here to hatch their young and watch them grow. Is more than welcomed, for they, their young, and all the weaker animals make possible the survival of other species of animals, predators like the snowy owl and the Arctic wolf. Predators are useful to nature in the Arctic, for they help prevent overpopulation. Already, competition for the limited food resources is fierce. And overpopulation could lead to the destruction of whole species. No sooner has the predator killed than other animals descend upon the prize, taking their share of the spoils. Plants, even the earth itself, take their share of the kill. The destruction of life in particular, life as a whole is preserved. The supply and demand of plants and animals are kept in a delicate balance. Here, man has not yet tinkered with the logic of nature. With the coming of winter, the struggle for survival increases. Those that can fly travel south to warmer regions. Survival grows sharper. Food becomes life, and life becomes food. Here, the struggle between the forces of life and the forces of a very hostile environment is in constant evidence. Despite the snow, the wind, and the bitter cold, despite the barrenness and the coming winter darkness, life will survive here, at least until the next ice age.
I put that film on so that you could see that the Arctic communities are complex and interrelated. And from the commentary on the film, you may get the impression that nature is so delicately balanced there that any attempt to study one part of it in isolation would be impossible. And indeed, among the rival schools of thought about how to study these lemming fluctuations, there is one school which says you must go to the Arctic and it is no good trying to abstract any part of this situation and study it elsewhere. Now you can see from the last frames that the Arctic is a pretty tough place to study small mammals in winter. Also, it would take a lot longer, require a lot many more people, and cost a lot more money to go to the Arctic to study these problems. So the trick in most scientific investigations is to see if it is possible to find an experimental animal which can be used to study certain selected aspects of an otherwise intractable problem. And Mr. Elton, some years ago, decided that with the difficulties of studying the Arctic in winter, and also despite the pleasantness of the Arctic in summer, the associated insects, here a few outside somebody's house, black flies, mosquitoes, midges, it would be better if one could find an experimental animal to study closer to home. And the animal he chose was the vole, V-O-L-E, a little meadow mouse, which can be found anywhere in rough grassland in the Northern Hemisphere. And this animal has been the subject of studies all over the world in an attempt to understand fluctuations in small mammals with the idea that eventually, having derived certain general principles, one might be able to go back to the Arctic and see if they too applied to the lemmings. Now, in order to study these animals, all you have to do is to invent a mouse trap and then escape from the world, which according to Emerson is going to beat a path to your door. And you escape from them and go out in the country and you find yourself a nice piece of grassland. And here is a study site that my wife and I studied after the war. And for the benefit of the younger members here, I'm referring to the Second World War, not the First. And for Many years we studied these problems together in Wales, and the area we chose was convenient because it had a lake into which the voles could commit suicide if that's the way they controlled their numbers. And this area was surrounded by unfavorable ground so that it was free from immigration. And the only escape from it was along this road, apart from going into the lake. It had a wide variety of vegetation so that one could see if the fluctuations occurred in good habitat as well as in bad. Now, to cut a long story short, let's move forward 30 years. And here we are still doing this sort of trapping. Now, in saying we, I don't wish to deceive you, because while in respect to my wife, it is true that age cannot wither her, nor custom stale her infinite variety, this particular slide is not relevant to that problem. This is one of our honor students, Miss Janine Kara, with whom I had the privilege of working for 1 year on this problem. This is out in the area near the wildlife refuge on Westham Island. Now, as you see, Janine is working at a highly sophisticated piece of apparatus. This equivalent of the electron microscope in mouse research, a traveling workbench with all the things you require to carry on this study. Now, unfortunately, Janine didn't have a real respect for this advanced technology, and she said if I was going to boast about it, at least I should show the apparatus in what she regarded as its typical resting place, which was on its side. However, in the right hands, this can be made to function, and with this pair of pliers and some fingerling fish tags, you can put a little tag in the ears of these animals. You can then weigh them and release them and set your traps and have them come back again. In this way, if you do this off and on for 40 or 50 years, you begin to see some sort of pattern emerging. And the pattern which emerges is shown in this slide, which is the first study I ever did before the Second World War, and has turned out to be fairly typical of what goes on in these populations everywhere in the world. This is a logarithmic scale, and it shows, first of all, that there was a very rapid increase, or at least it doesn't show that. You'll have to take my word for it. Our techniques were not good enough to measure it in those days. Secondly, there is a decline throughout the winter, which is this brown bar here. And then after the start of growth in spring, there is a very rapid disappearance of the overwintered population. However, they have started to breed, and they do breed at a high rate throughout the breeding season. But you will notice that in spite of this rapid rate of breeding, numbers do not increase until towards the end of the season, when they come back up to what they used to be. Now then a remarkable thing happens. In the second winter, numbers may go down about at the same rate as they did the previous winter, or a little bit faster sometimes, but then they start to go down really rapidly, and the overwintering population, instead of lasting through until the following winter, is usually gone by the middle of summer. And in this particular occasion, there was no breeding at all, and the population died out and was scarce up until the outbreak of war in 1939. Now, if we skip forward exactly 40 years to another study, which was done by Terry Beecham, who was at the same stage in his career as I was then, getting his PhD, you will see that we have essentially the same story, in spite of enormous differences in the local situation. Here he had a very rapid increase, up to a peak which he couldn't measure because there were too many animals, but was somewhere around there. A slow decline throughout the winter, a slight drop in the spring, the same as I had, perhaps an earlier recovery than I had, to a peak the following winter, which again was about the same as it had been the previous winter. The population declined fairly rapidly, certainly more rapidly than in the previous winter. And again, when we come to the end of winter, the numbers drop down very rapidly. In his case, the numbers did not go to extinction. Breeding started, and there was some sort of recovery just before he ended this study. So here we have what looks like a common pattern in spite of the differences in the situation here and in Wales. Now, one of the difficulties is that every population is unique. And our populations here are unique in a number of respects. For example, the voles around here suffer very badly from bot flies or warble flies. And here you see the underside of one of these delightful animals carrying three bots. And there is a certain amount of mortality due to that. Now, that particular source of mortality is absent from the populations we studied in Wales. In many cases, there is extensive damage to the vegetation. Here is an example following an outbreak in Oregon about 20 or 30 years ago, and you will see that the fields are devastated, and undoubtedly, some mortality must have been due to starvation. Also, you have a variety of predators mopping the animals up, and again, the range of predators is different in different places. Here, we also have this pest, this heron. And as you'll see, it is a heavy predator on bulls. And why anybody wants to preserve these pesky animals when they keep eating our precious marked bulls is beyond me. And of course, there are often bad instances of bad weather which are associated with the declines. Now, essentially, science is a search for uniformities in spite of differences, in spite of the chaotic surface appearance of events. One has the faith that underlying them there may be certain general principles. And in order to try to sort out some of these local variables from the main theme we're interested in, you have to resort to experimental methods. And the sort of thing one can do is to try to exclude predators, for example, by fencing against aerial predators, as in this study. This area here was fenced over to keep the predators out. And you can do various other things to try to exclude what you regard as a local complexity. Now, it's time to turn the clock back from these vole studies to 1959, when a very important event occurred. Now, if Elton can be regarded as the father of animal ecology, it would not be altogether without justification for me to claim to be the son. And lest you should get any false analogies, I wish to introduce a third individual, namely Dr. Charles Krebs, who must be regarded as the grandson. And in 1959, this bright young student was about to start his PhD. And as I was by that time well known for my profound studies of lemmings at Baker Lake, I was invited to come over here to UBC and help advise in the setting up of Dr. Krebs's PhD thesis. And, of course, I was able to say that if there are going to be voles anywhere in the eastern Arctic, there would certainly be some at Baker Lake. So Dr. Krebs, he wasn't a doctor then, went up to Baker Lake. And just in the same way that Elton had made a mistake about which year was going to be a high or low, so in 1959 there were hardly any lemmings at Baker Lake. However, this was very convenient because Dr. Krebs was in at the start of a cycle and was able to follow it through to its completion. And this remains the outstanding and definitive piece of work on the lemming cycle in the north. He used a variety of methods, some of them involving snap traps, which enables you to study the stomach contents, the fat content, the endocrine organs, and so forth. He also looked carefully at the damage caused by the lemmings to the vegetation and tried to rule out the effects of the lemmings feeding, or at least to assay it, by having this exclosure so that you can see what the vegetation is like in the absence of lemming pressure. Now, I don't want to go into all the details of his work, but just to extract from it one very interesting thing to me especially, which was that he came up with the following population curve. And you will see a certain familiarity to the ones which I have already shown you. Here we have a rapid increase over the winter. They were extremely scarce when he first went there in the summer of 59. Rapid increase under the snow that winter to a peak spring. A drop in the spring. Level numbers throughout the summer, back again to the same peak in the winter, and then a decline almost to extinction the following year. That was on one of his areas. On another area, he had this partial recovery and then a decline in the second winter, which was a pattern that we too had observed in our studies at Lake Vyrnwy. So, in spite of all the differences, we think that there is some common pattern which has to be understood. Now, those who would take what is called a holistic or ecosystem approach to studying this problem are nevertheless guilty of leaving out many aspects of the problem. And you, as a highly intelligent audience, will at once have spotted the obvious deficiencies in the study. Though it took us a good many years to get to this point, you will at once have seen that we need to study this condition here when there is no rapid increase in spite of the breeding, and you will obviously have seen a possible connection between that and the decrease the following winter. You will have said to yourselves, now, if Charles Darwin is right, there will be heavy selection at this point, and the animals which enter the second winter will differ in quality from the animals which enter this winter following this rapid increase, or this peak year. And is it possible then that there has been a sufficient change in certain properties of the animals so that these animals, although no more crowded than those, in some way interact differently and decline? Now, it took us a long time to get that idea, and not many people accept it as being a worthwhile study. However, one must pursue one's own pet notions, and at the present time, a good many of us are interested in the behavior of these animals. And the question is, how do you set up, in the limited space which is available, something approaching a natural community so that you can study the interactions between these animals? And thanks to student Kerry Delaney, I have some pictures showing you the sort of work which is going on at the moment. This is a room up at the Animal Care Center, and here you will see a number of runways and a subdivided room with food and water for the animals. And here we have a population of two or three dozen animals, which one hopes are behaving in something of the manner of a natural population. The system is to sit and watch these animals, take notes on their behavior, and find out if, in fact, there are differences in the behavior and if it could have any possible relevance to understanding what goes on in the field. These animals breed extremely well, and here we have a litter under the glass, which forms the substitute for the cover which they normally live under. And this work is going on rapidly at the present time. Now, it's always much nicer if you actually see animals than see still pictures of them. And so very shortly, Sharon and I are going to show you the sorts of things which are of interest to us. Now, some of you may have seen those features they put on the TV every now and then called bloopers, in which things which shouldn't happen have happened to actors, and these are cut out of the final production. And if you string them all together, it makes a very entertaining hour's program. And one of these that I saw recently involved animals and all the dreadful things they can do which are not part of the script. And one of the most hilarious, I think, was the time they brought in a young elephant for some reason or other. And of course it did the unmentionable to start with. And then it trod on the foot of one of the actors. And the last thing we saw in that clip was the elephant rushing out of the room, dragging its keeper behind it. Now, W.C. Fields has said, in fact, that if you want animals in your show, you should have them painted on the walls because they always do the wrong thing. And in fact, there is a saying, the Harvard Law of Animal Behavior, that under carefully controlled conditions, animals do as they damn please. So I don't know what's going to happen now when Sharon and I exhibit our animals to you, and I'm sure it will disrupt the program. And it seems to me that before we risk this sort of thing, I should at least answer the question, which is the subject of this talk. Now, I said that the camera cannot lie, but I didn't say that it may not be very good at faking. And so when we look at the photographic evidence, we naturally want to know who the scientist was that took those pictures. And it turns out that it was Walt Disney in both cases. Now, it may be that he has seen what no other scientist has seen. On the other hand, one can't help but be a little suspicious when one comes across an item like this in the newspaper. In 1963, when a film company advertised for live lemmings at a price of 10 cents each, several thousand were said to have been caught and forwarded for the reward to the film company. So it is just possible that those marches and that suicide is staged. But we shouldn't be too skeptical, and we should at least search the scientific literature for perhaps documentary evidence. But the best I can come up with in the scientific literature of an actual picture of a lemming migration is this one, my final slide. So my answer to the question is that no, lemmings do not commit suicide, though they may move around a good deal at certain times of their cycle. But the last word must go to the grandson, who, after all, is the only one who has made a thorough study of a four-year cycle. Charles Krebs wrote in his published article, published from those studies I've told you about, "From 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. on June the 2nd, I observed 25 lemmings moving individually on the lake ice." You'll note 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. We mousers never sleep. And in his discussion, he writes as follows, "I have been told by people at Baker Lake that during the 1960 spring," which was when he observed these 25 lemmings on the ice, "there were millions of lemmings marching across the tundra towards Hudson Bay. Thus, when spring movements do occur, there is a tendency to exaggerate their size. A few tens of lemmings quickly become a few hundreds in the mind, and to the next person, the number is in the thousands." So, the answer, I think, on the present evidence must be lemmings do not commit suicide. But we still don't know why they die off in such numbers. And if we had not blown a tire this year, I might have had another 2 or 3 years to work on the answer to this problem. In the meantime, all I can do is show you the sorts of things we are doing to try to understand the behavior of the lemmings. So Sharon, would you unveil our exhibit, please? Need to open the doors. Now, I should say that one of the nice things about being in a university is that one has this continual contact with students. And not only can you ask students to take up parts of the problem that you're interested in, but also you can be quite sure that they are not going to believe what you say and that they are going to find out something that is quite opposite of what you had told them to find out. So Sharon and I perhaps might discuss how it is that we came to work together. Now Sharon, would you like to come up and take this mic and we can just talk about your work. You have to get rather close to the mic. Okay. Sharon was a student, or was a student last term of Dr. Lilly, who is our behavior expert, and he is always grateful for anybody who can suggest a project for his students, and perhaps Sharon would like to take up the story from that point on.
Okay. We had to do a project in this animal behavior course.
Can you hear? No. Okay. Can you get louder?
And okay, for this animal behavior course, we had to do a project. Okay, thanks. And I got in contact with Dr. Chitty and I saw his voles and I thought it would be interesting to study them. It looked like a nice arrangement and it was inside and it was dry and our experiment was supposed to be done during the winter months. So I worked on the voles. And what I studied was, well, Dr. Chitty has put out a hypothesis which discusses a genetic basis for the behavior of voles. Supposedly, the large voles are docile and the small voles are aggressive. Perhaps he will tell you more about this later, but so what I wanted to do was to test this hypothesis by getting families of large voles and small voles. So what I did was I took sibling groups of two large parents and then sibling groups of two small parents. And then I took these individual voles and then matched them up in cages. And I opened up the cages and just let them go at each other, two by two. And so I tested between large voles and small voles, just every possible mixture. And the way I quantified my data was I noted the frequencies of different behaviors, for instance, biting, scratching, fighting, things like that. And what I found, to Dr. Chitty's surprise perhaps, was that there was actually an inverse correlation. I found that large voles tended to be more aggressive. So it was exactly, it disproved, in a way, his hypothesis.
I hope Dr. Lilly didn't give you a very good mark on that.
Well, I got 80%, so that's not too bad.
I'll have to talk to Dr. Lilly about that, obviously. So, that experiment bombed, and we had various explanations. It could be that the basic ideas were unsound, or else that the experimenter wasn't much good. And we found we were unable to agree on which of these was true, and so we compromised on the idea that the test perhaps was inappropriate. Now, this rejection of bright ideas is probably the thing that we do most frequently in science. And there's a saying of Thomas Henry Huxley that the most terrible thing about science is the slaying of a beautiful hypothesis by an ugly fact. And I am very grateful for Sharon's help in slaying this particular hypothesis, because it leads on to the next kind of investigation. And this particular setup was constructed specially for this lecture by a student from Australia who came here and had a little time that she was prepared to donate. And very fortunately, she went skiing and did herself a terrible injury to her leg, and so she was immobilized for quite a long time, and she finished the construction of this display. Now, the idea of this is that you have the animals living in their cages, and they are able to come up into a runway system, which is supposed to simulate the kind of runways we get in nature. And the great difficulty about this sort of work in the past has been that when you have a lot of voles crowded into the space, the limited space that you have in a laboratory, you introduce quite unnatural conditions. And the way we have tried to get around this is by subdividing the habitat into these runways that you see them using. And we can sit and watch these interactions and see if there's anything at all relevant to the sorts of things we think are going on in nature. Now, although we haven't used this apparatus for that kind of study yet, but we've done them in that room that you saw the photograph of, nevertheless, the sorts of things that have come out of these other studies are that probably the key to our understanding of the behavior of these animals is that of the pregnant and lactating females. Because the surprising thing has been the astonishing viciousness of the females when they have a nest to defend. And nobody dare go near the nest, such as I showed you in that slide of Carrie's, without getting severely beaten up. Now, it's very unlikely that these animals are going to do anything spectacular, but they will provide perhaps an interesting backdrop during the question period. And with any luck, they will be acting up later on. And Sharon and I would very much like it if some of you would come down and have a look a little bit more closely and perhaps talk to us about this work. So thank you, Sharon, for your help, and you'll be around after the question period. So that is all we have to say for the time being, ladies and gentlemen, and we hope to continue the discussion down here later on.
Well, Dr. Chitty, I'm sure we'll receive questions. I think to simplify arrangements, I'll just have Dr. Chitty himself receive the questions and answer them, and then I will ask a colleague to thank him subsequently. So if you just raise your hand, and Dr. Chitty will indicate which of you he would like to respond to first.
You speak of lemmings in the eastern Arctic. Do they exist in the western Arctic as well?
They do. They are right across Canada and right into Alaska. I just selected a little piece of the story. The fluctuations are not synchronous across the whole of Canada, but they tend to be synchronous in the east and tend to be synchronous in the west, and sometimes the two are together and sometimes they are not. The normal length of pregnancy is 20... Oh, very seldom do they live from one breeding season to the next. They nearly always do their breeding 1 year and die out during the following winter. There are a few which get through into a second breeding season, but very, very few indeed.
How do they survive the winter?
They are under snow cover, which gives them good protection from the very low temperatures, and they manage to feed on roots and so forth. Questions of that sort, I think, should be addressed to Dr. Krebs over here, who I hope will also come down at the end of the question period. Oh.
According to ecology of nature, predators are supposed to increase with the increased population of the hunted.
Yes. The observation was that the predators of these herbivores increase when there is abundant food for them. And that is the explanation for the fluctuation in the Arctic fur returns, that when there is plenty of lemming food, the Arctic foxes breed, have large litters, the young survive, and therefore there are many of them available for the trappers that winter. Then when the lemmings go, the surplus animals, surplus foxes, starve, and breeding season the next year is very poor, and so the fur return drops right off. The Eskimos have nothing to trade at the Hudson's Bay Company stores, and it's a very sparse time in the Arctic for man and beast.
If it's not true that lemmings commit suicide, how did the story get so wide release?
The question is, how did this so-called myth of the lemming migrations receive so much acceptance? I think the answer is given by Dr. Krebs's observation that it is simply an old wives' tale that gets exaggerated, passed from mouth to mouth, and grows each time in very much the same way that a fish story grows from the actual size of the fish to what the people say they have caught. And when you look at the actual dates of the so-called scientific observations mentioned in Mr. Elton's book, you will find that they're nearly all 1910 and earlier. And so it seems more than likely that most of these are exaggerated accounts from people who have been impressed, as indeed one must be impressed, by the number of lemmings running hither and yon in a peak year. It is a very impressive sight, and that can easily be exaggerated in people's imagination.
Have any people found them palatable at
all? The question is, are they good to eat? People who have been in desperate straits through having lost their supplies in the Arctic have made lemming stews, but the reports on them are not very favorable. This is only an emergency measure. Nor are they of much commercial value, because some people thought that, particularly with the Norwegian lemmings, a number of skins would make a very attractive coat. But this has turned out not to be a very economical venture. Question is, what part do diseases play in the lemming cycle? According to Mr. Elton in 1927, this was the explanation for the decline, that through overcrowding in their natural habitats, they passed disease very readily from one to the other. Epidemics spread like wildfire and wiped the population out. This was the job I was given when I went to Oxford, to find the disease which was doing the same sort of thing to the experimental animal, the vole. And in conjunction with the pathologist, Dr. Wells, I sent animals for investigation, and he put them in cages expecting that they would die of this infectious disease. But as soon as one got them out of the field, they lived very, very well for months on end in a very healthy manner, and there was no evidence of the sort of disease one was looking for. So this was another
beautiful hypothesis slain by an ugly fact, and we assume that the same thing is true for the lemmings, that although they do have diseases, it is probably what makes them susceptible to diseases and everything else which kills animals that we should study. Now, you never can tell with this pure research what's going to turn up that might be of some, in quote, use. And although we didn't discover a disease which could account for the decline in the vole populations, Dr. Wells did discover an entirely unknown form of tuberculosis. And this was used about the start of the war to vaccinate human beings against tuberculosis because it was regarded as somewhat safer than the BCG, which is an attenuated human bacillus, which sometimes was not attenuated sufficiently. So occasionally something useful comes out of this sort of work.
Do lemmings, when they fight to the death, or do they do it in a ritualistic manner?
The question is, are the combats between these animals lethal, or is there some sort of ritual to it? We don't really know the answer to that in the field. We strongly suspect that there is no actual dying from wounds, but it is quite likely that because of the interactions between them, they use up so much energy that they overstimulate their metabolism and are therefore more prone to die of cold and food shortage and become susceptible to diseases. But actual killing probably doesn't occur in the wild. It is more likely that they move out and die perhaps in unfavorable habitats. But this is not the way it is in the laboratory, because there they are unable to escape from one another as a rule, and the wounding can be lethal, or at least a horrible thing to see. And therefore, one of the great technical difficulties that had to be overcome before one could do population studies in the lab was to manage to give them a habitat in which they could escape from one another and not suffer these horrible wounds. It is a most remarkable sight to see a couple of aggressive voles fighting.
I wonder if I could rescue our speaker from the consequences of his own courtesy by limiting questions to one more question. If there is one more question. If not, I would...
Oh, no. Or is she just pointing at the lemmings?
Another question? Okay. One last question.
Yeah. Your hypothesis of interrelation for populations has been largely done with small mammals, as you said, trigger science and find the pursuit of a animal. Do you envision it being applicable for either insects or for with short lifespans as well, or for animals, other mammals or fish with longer life expectancy?
There speaks one of our honors students throwing a curve ball at me. He is trying to make me stick my neck out further than I have been prepared to do so. But to be honest, yes, I think that this phenomenon is not restricted to small mammals. And my authority for that is simply the statement of Darwin that populations which increase exponentially differ from those which are stationary in numbers, and that this is because natural selection is going on. Now, all animals are capable of this exponential increase, but most of them are regulated, and therefore I would expect that the main peculiarity of my views, that natural selection must be studied if we're going to understand these fluctuations, I would think that that principle at least applies far more widely. There was one more question here. You were going.
Yes, I have a question back to the what we have now learned, the myth of the migration of lemmings. Does this occur in tables and sagas going back a very long time, or simply a natural coincidence that you read to us in the general model?
The question is, how far back in history can we trace this myth? In the 16th century, there is a remarkable woodcut showing lemmings coming down from the sky. In those days, they explained both the increase supernaturally and the decrease by this migration. Now, we no longer accept the view that they fall from the sky, as they did in the 16th century, but a good many people still accept the idea that they end their period of abundance through suicide. So yes, these lemming years are well known and recorded in the folklore of the Scandinavian countries.
Just before introducing the person who will thank our speaker, let me draw to your attention that coffee and cookies will be available, correct? We hope so. In the lobby after this, it will be just after you walk past the membership desk. The possibility does exist that your behavior in having coffee and cookies is also an experiment being monitored by the Animal Resource Unit. But I'm not convinced of that. Let me ask Dr. Cass Lindsay, the director of the Institute of Animal Resource Ecology, to thank our speaker for this evening.
Mr. Chairman, I was particularly happy to be asked to thank Dennis Chitty tonight because it so happens I gave a talk earlier in the week and Dennis Chitty had the chance to thank me. In truth, it's difficult to come up with any witty repartee because Dr. Chitty, as usual, has been elegant and educational and entertaining. I think it's pretty obvious from the three-ring circus that he's put on tonight why he won the Master Teacher Award. It's characteristic of Dennis that whatever he does, he really puts maximum effort into. The only criticism I can suggest is that those of us who came here just wanting to know the answer to the question, do lemmings commit suicide, have, I'm afraid, gone home rather disappointed. We have been told, and the answer was succinctly displayed in the first slide. But also, as I've also found as characteristic in having anything to do with Dennis, one tends to get seduced into thinking more widely and more deeply about things than one had really intended to begin with. Well, Dennis, it has been pointed out, is a member at large of the Vancouver Institute. He's the usher, he's the bouncer, he's the speaker, and I would like to go on thanking him at greater length, but I was just passed a note asking if he would go downstairs to the men's room because they're having trouble with a leaky tap. So we thank Charles Elton and Helen Chitty and Charlie Krebs and particularly Sharon and all little voles, but most of all, thank you very much, Professor Dennis Chitty.